The following message was recorded at the No Regrets Men's Conference. More information about the conference is available at noregretsconference.org. Feel free to make copies of this message for others, but please do not charge for those copies or alter the content in any way without permission.
Let me introduce our speaker. He's 10 years here with Elmbrook Church. Started out with the children's ministry. I had the privilege of having my daughter attend his classes. She still loves him. He's our executive pastor here, and I want to introduce to you Brody Swanson.
All right. Well, you clapped beforehand. You might not be clapping at the end, so thank you for that. Really good to see you guys. We got a lot to cover today, what I'll try to do is get through a lot of what's on here. Some of the handout will be helpful. Some of it won't be because I changed my mind last night on a couple of things, but there's a lot that will be helpful on there. And then I'll try to leave time for question and answer at the end if there's any of that. Like was said, I started out here as a children's pastor, an elementary pastor, actually, just with elementary kids. Have gone to children's, children, family, next gen, and now I get to serve here as executive pastor. And I'm married for 16 years. Been leading in a church setting for all of those 16 years, and I have two kids, which is where my most important leadership and empowering happens, which is in my home. They are 3 years old and 8 years old, and on a daily basis, as I'm sure some of your kids or grandkids, they war against my soul, and that's kind of the way that that works. So what I would tell you is that my background in leadership is really learning hands-on. I don't have a master's degree in leadership development, but my master's in some other stuff. But I've learned in a hands-on way, and a lot of what you're going to hear today will even have happened in a church staffing range or with a group of young people that we hire every summer that's about 110 to 120 college age and high school, and developing leaders and how to empower developing leaders. Now, just so I have a little bit of context for who's in here, how many of you are a leader on a church staff at all? Anybody? Leader on a church staff. Okay. How about a leader of teams in the business community, marketplace, stuff like that? How many of you lead teams of volunteers, either in the community or in the church? How many of you somewhere fall not in any of those categories but are interested in the topic? All right. There we go. I think we got almost everybody. So I'll try to hit a lot of these things. But if I'm moving quickly and I only give a slice of perspective, please feel free to kind of translate that into whatever environment that you're in. One of my passions is to have teams developed within the local church that will move the kingdom forward, not just in the church building, but within the local body of believers, so that people are together, that they're moving forward, and that Jesus looks good because of it. And that's how the kingdom moves forward. My belief, though, is that if you are a leader, and I am a leader, then our responsibility is to steward the gifts and the people that are put right in front of us. So if you are a leader of a team, if you are a parent, if you are a grandparent, if you are in a collection of people, one of your jobs as a leader is to steward the gifts and the people that are in that place. And so that's the foundation for all that we're going to talk about today. And so I want to jump in and talk about, what does it mean to empower people? Now, I looked up the definition, and I think it's pretty powerful, of empower. Here's what it says: to give someone the authority or power to do something, or to make someone stronger and more confident in claiming their life and their rights or their leadership. I think that's really interesting to say, to give someone authority or power to do something. That's an organizational thing. But on a personal level, to make someone stronger and more confident. That's what empowering is really all about. And we are surrounded by people that are constantly told that they are not something. They're not enough. They don't do enough. They can never be enough. And they are constantly needing to be empowered. So how do you empower people? And we're going to talk about it at two levels: empowering individuals and empowering teams. And some of this will be things that I've learned, and some will be things that you have heard. But here's what I know about we as people, is that we ingest information on four levels. If it's the first time you've heard it, you'll go, wow, I did not realize that. I really, really want to grab onto that. Second time you hear that same piece of information, you'll go, oh, yeah, I remember I heard that once, and it will remind you of something. The third time you hear it, you go through the stage of the, I already heard that, been there, done that, I'm bored. And that's usually when speakers stop saying things, is when they feel like their audience is bored. I will continue to keep going, all right? And that's not because I'm ignorant of that, because there's a fourth level that we all need to get to, and that is the I know it without you telling me, okay? We want to get past the wow. We want to get through the oh, yeah. We want to get past the I'm bored. And I want you, and you want people in your general vicinity to get to the point where they know things without us telling them again. And so we're going to jump in. How do you empower people? I think there's six things that we need to not underestimate the power of. And we often underestimate the power of these things because they seem to be basics and they seem to be background things, but I'm going to expand on them. The first is, do not underestimate the power of asking people. Don't underestimate the power of drawing people into something that is of importance. If you're in a church setting or a ministry setting, it's a kingdom purpose. If you're into a business or a marketplace setting, you probably firmly believe in whatever it is that you've invested your life in at that point in time. And so drawing people in, never underestimate the power of asking. Now, here's the interesting thing. Jesus was an asker. He was an asker. Listen to Matthew chapter 4, verses 18 through 22. Here's what it says. As Jesus was walking beside the Sea of Galilee, he saw two brothers, Simon called Peter and his brother Andrew, and they were casting a net into the lake, for they were fishermen. Come, follow me, Jesus said, and I will make you fishers of men. At once they left their nets and followed him. Going on from there, he saw two other brothers, James, son of Zebedee, and his brother John, and they were in the boat with their father Zebedee, preparing their nets, and Jesus called to them, and immediately they left their boat and their father and followed him. Now, I think it's really interesting that when Jesus chose to go out and gather a group of people that he was going to ultimately empower to do something, he didn't put a poster up in town. He didn't have email and text messaging and internet and newspapers and all of those things. He went individually to somebody and he said, hey, this is something worth jumping in on. I want you to be a part of this. And if you're going to empower people, empowering doesn't happen just so you can say nice things to somebody or make them feel better about themselves. Empowerment always leads us towards something. And whatever it is that you're leading them towards is something they need to be invited into. Now, I don't know if you've done this a lot, but I've had the opportunity to be around people who were askers and inviters, and I've also had the opportunity to do that. When I was a children's pastor in Rockford, Illinois, I was teaching children's church one Sunday morning, and in the back, right at the end of children's church, there's this short little guy. He walked in, his wife, a little bit shorter than he was, right next to him, and they stood in the back. And if you're a children's pastor and strangers come and stand in the back of a room, that's a bad thing because you're thinking safety and security. You're like, what kind of person is this? And so it was the end of children's church. I bowed my head, I prayed with the kids, and when I looked up, they were gone, which raised a whole bunch more red flags. I was like, okay, what's going on? And so it kind of left my mind. I tried to see if they were in the hallway. They were long gone. Next week, same thing. I'm up in front, getting near the end. They walk into the back. They stand there, and I prayed, and this time I did the same dumb thing again. I closed my eyes, which you never do with kids anyways, but you know, I closed my eyes, and they disappeared, and I thought, oh, you missed an opportunity. Third week, same thing. I got smart. And so I was up in front. I decided to pray. And as I was praying, I walked with my eyes open around the back and I stood at the door, which was the only way out of that room, and made sure that they couldn't leave. And I started to meet them. And the guy's name was John and his wife's name was Denise. And they were just new to the church. And like, hey, we were checking things out, just looking around at what's going on. And I in my youth, which I'd never known to intentionally do this, I said, well, hey, why don't you come and be a part of this for a while? I really love what's going on in here. Would you be part of this for a while? And they said, sure. So they came back the next week. I found out through conversation with them over the next couple months that they had been leaders in a children's ministry. They were phenomenal with the kids. And I started to be able to ask them to take on more and more and more things. And about a year and a half later, when I received the call to come to Elmbrook and I left that place, those two took over the children's ministry in my place, the children's ministry about 400 or 500 kids. Not because they were so compelled by an advertisement in the bulletin, but because they were asked and there was a relationship. There's a guy around here, and I don't think he's in here, so I'm not going to out him at all. But his name is Rich Parfrey, and Rich Parfrey is the best asker ever. And what I used to do, he was the commissioner of our Upward basketball league, and I used to walk through the building with him near the beginning. And Scott Fry back there is our coach's coordinator. He knows this how this works. But we were walking through the building, and he would, without fail, everybody he came up to, he'd shake their hand. He'd ask how they're doing. He goes, "Upward's coming. You want to be a coach this year? Upward's coming. Do you want to be on the prayer team this year?" And we never had gaps in those teams because he was constantly asking. And anybody in those positions, the power of asking is not something that we can underestimate, because when we draw people in, we are much more able to then empower them. Don't underestimate the power of asking. Second, don't underestimate the power of encouragement. Power of encouragement. Now, you may think this is the biggest duh, and I may think this is the biggest duh, but this is not a head thing that we're talking about. I want for a second just to dig down and say this is a heart thing. And I actually experienced that this week, the power of encouragement. And I got to thank the guy personally just down in the lower lobby. This year on Tuesday, February 2nd, Groundhog Day, was my 10-year anniversary here at Elmbrook. I don't know why it means something to me. It might be that I just never made it anywhere else 10 years in a row. And so I thought, this is a big deal. And for me, it was a big deal. And a couple of the elders around here found out that it was my 10th anniversary. And one of them sent me an email that said, "Hey, thanks for making it 10 years. And then went four dots down in specific encouraging things that were really meaningful and really built on observation. And it just didn't hit me here going, "Oh yeah, he did his duty. He sent me an email." It hit me right here. And it made me feel differently about myself. It made me notice things in myself that maybe I hadn't thought of in a while, because encouragement is a big deal. 1 Thessalonians 5 says this: continue to encourage one another and what? Build each other up. I think that scripture uses great vocabulary that sometimes we just totally gloss over, okay? Because we live in a culture that is constantly tearing us down, okay? I read things that tell me how I'm, especially on Facebook, okay? I see dads who are doing these amazing things, and I just ripped into my kid for something. And I'm like, I am not a great dad. And then you see these husbands who are always sending flowers, like they've got unlimited finances. And I'm like, I got my wife a carnation, and she likes carnations. But I'm constantly going, man, I'm just not enough. I'm not doing enough. I need to think about this more. And there's not enough time in the day to be the person that I'm supposed to be, right? And so our world and our culture is constantly chopping away at our self-esteem and our self-confidence and those of people around you, even though you would look around at the people around you and go, "They got it together. They're doing pretty good. Their kids seem to be doing okay. Their marriage is doing okay." But you haven't been behind the closed doors of their house and what it looked like to leave this morning and things like that. And what we need to do is not underestimate the power of encouragement. Now, encouragement can come in a bunch of different ways. Sometimes we think, well, I just need to say the right things. Well, how often do you say the right thing? Very rarely do I say the right thing. About an hour later, I figured out what I should have said. But how often do you say the right thing? But there's some other ways that I have seen encouragement built that might be helpful to you, and it's been helpful to me. First, we can set up environments that all would automatically lead towards encouragement. My first job was a day camp counselor job, and went on to this staff with a bunch of other high school and college age young people, and it was about 200 kids and about 25 or 30 staff. And at the end of the first week, the boss came in and he put a box right in the middle of the thing. He said, "All right, from here on out, all summer long, if you catch somebody doing something well, then I want you to write it down. I want you to put it in there. I want you to put their name on it. I want you to say what they did, and I want you to sign your name, because we're not doing this anonymous stuff." And he goes, "Now I'm going to draw a couple names, and we're going to actually sort through those every week and see who got the most votes." And then there was this little bear about this big, stupid Oriental trading thing. You know what those things are like. You know, the kind of things that you walk around at night and you step on if you have kids or grandkids. And so he said, "I'm going to give this bear, it's the staff person of the week bear." And I was like, okay. And then as people started to get the staff person of the week bear, I found this competitive nature in me going, I want that bear. I want to get that bear. And so I was upping my batting average on how I was doing. I was doing extra cleanup. I was there early to do setup. I was trying to be the best so that I could be part of that thing and that somebody would notice that I was doing well. And the eighth week, the last week, I got that bear. And when I picked it up, it wasn't heavy. It wasn't of any significance except for the fact that somebody had noticed, a couple of somebodies had noticed that I actually did something worth recognizing. And you know what? I have that bear on the shelf in my basement today so that when I look at that, I remember what those people thought of me and that experience because my boss, who ended up being my mentor, built an environment of encouragement. One of the things we do around here, very simple, but it's changed the tenor of staff meetings, is that we went from making staff meetings the beginning of them, you know, you go through the litany of announcements and updates and all those different things. We just have people turn to the people around and we have them sit at tables now and we say, all right, we're going to do shout outs and wins. If you saw somebody going above and beyond, then I want you to talk about that at your table. In a minute, we're going to tell stories in this and you can either tell a story that you've seen or you can share what somebody else at your table said because that's fair game too. And I will tell you that the people who are getting shout outs are not the ones who stand up on the platform. They're just not. It's not about the message on the weekend. It's not about the brilliant teaching in all these places. The people that are getting the shout outs that are getting noticed that would never get noticed before are the building services guys who came and helped us clean up a mess when kids spilled glitter all over the floor. It was the person in graphic arts who had to redo a graphic at the end and somebody noticed. And these people that never got shout outs. And that is going a long way towards building their confidence and building their morale if we set an environment of encouragement. Second thing, though, it doesn't always have to be words that encourage. It can be your body language. And I've learned this with my kids, and I learned this through experience. Now, I played sports all throughout high school and into college. I played soccer and basketball and golf at the high school and college level. Not D1, so don't even think that I'm an athlete. But I have two bad knees to prove that I did something. And what happened was is in high school, my freshman year, I went in, and I was not a very good player. And the coach there thought I was a good player, and so he started me, and I got eaten alive, absolutely eaten alive at the varsity level. And we got a new coach halfway through the year, and he sat me so far at the end of the bench I couldn't hear him talk. And so he did. And in practice every day from that point until through the next year, every day in practice, whenever I missed a pass, when there could have been a diagonal pass, when I didn't hit the right play, when we didn't have the right cut because I was a point guard, he would rail on me. I mean, he would go after me verbally, not like swearing or whatever, because I went to a Christian school, but he wasn't giving me a break. I mean, he would call me out. And then when I did something good, silence. I was like, what is this? You don't know how to coach. And so I went through a whole year of that. And about halfway through my sophomore year, I finally saw the floor again, playing time. And it was really interesting because a couple games into, I subbed in the second half. And I'll remember this for the rest of my life. And I went to the left of the key and we deserved a diagonal pass to the post on the other side. And I faked here and I went one-handed bounce pass. Perfect assist right there. And I looked at my coach almost as if to say, see, I told you I could do this. And all he did was nod. He just nodded. And I thought, oh, he actually likes what I did. And I did something else good. Two things in a game. That was a miracle. But I did something else good. And I looked over at him again, and there was a nod. And I figured out that the reason I never heard anything from him is because he didn't verbally encourage me. It was body language. And I could tell whenever I did something well, it was a nod. And then he would turn and do something else. When it wasn't good, he would have his hands like this, and he'd be doing that whole thing. But it was nonverbal. And you know what? With my daughter, I have an 8-year-old daughter, and she is very attuned to my eyes. She will find my eyes anywhere in the room, and I can do this or I can do that, and we can communicate across the room without there being any verbal communication, and I can encourage her just by the way that I set my body language or I move my body and the agreements that we have on those type of things. So when I talk about encouragement, don't underestimate the power of an encouraging atmosphere. Also, your nonverbals, because your nonverbals speak 90% louder than your verbals. You can say really nice words looking like this, and they're not going to believe them. All right? And then also, pay attention to your words, because words make a difference. Don't underestimate the power of encouragement. Third thing, if we're going to empower people, is don't underestimate the power of relationship. Don't underestimate the power of relationship. It's hard to empower somebody you don't know. All right? Now, This is the hard part, is if you are leading in a large organization or in a large group of people, or you have a lot of people that you're connected with, how do you possibly get to know everybody at the level so that you can empower them? Now, I'm going to shamelessly rip off something from Saddleback Church, so know that this isn't mine. There's a lot of things that I'm going to talk about, and I'm going to give credit to where the ideas came from, but I'm also going to help you understand how I integrate those into my thinking. But when you are getting to know people, a lot of times we do, hey, how's it going? How was your day? How was your week? Tell me about your family. If we get really deep or we get over a cup of coffee, we'll be like, tell me your story. And we'll hear somebody's story. But it's really hard to empower someone from their story or from just an anecdotal story from their week. So how do you get deeper? What questions do you ask that can actually get you to a point where you would know how to employ them and empower them? And I would tell you that one of the things that I use is the acrostic, and it's on the back of your handout. It's called SHAPE. Okay? And this is just a way that I found with my kids, with my wife, with our small group, and with people that I lead, that I ask specific questions so that I get to know them just a little bit better and at a deeper level so that I can start to empower them to do things that they were created to do. Not things that I created for them to do, but things that they might naturally go in line with. And the S, as you can see on that thing, is spiritual gifts. This is church language, and we do this a lot, but I will tell you, if you are working with believers in the marketplace, ask them their spiritual gifts. Because if somebody says they have the gift of prophecy, it doesn't mean they can figure out the stock market 2 weeks from now. It means that they are always going to tell you the truth, no matter if you like it or not. And that is huge in the marketplace, just like it is in the church. Spiritual gifts are a big deal. If you have somebody that has the spiritual gift of teaching, it translates into a marketplace environment just like it does in the church. And people that do that may not yet have the confidence to do it, but they are born to do it. And I want you to know that when you start asking them questions, you might get to know them a little bit better, and you might actually remind them of who they are. And so the first one is spiritual gifts. Second one is heart. What gets them up in the morning? What do they get passionate about? What do they get jazzed about? That's not the Packers or the well, I don't know. Do we get jazzed about the Bucks? The Brewers or something like that, or golf or things like that. But what do they really get excited about? Do they get excited? If you would talk to our senior pastor here and say, what do you get most excited about? He will say without a doubt, and you won't see him today, but if you ever see him, just stop and say, what do you get most excited about? And he will say, transformed lives. When lives change because of Jesus, there is nothing that he loves more. But you know what? That's a senior pastor. That's where his heart and mind has been. You might find that somebody whose heart is to serve others, to make sure that they have a great experience, whatever environment they enter into. And you got to grab those people, because those people are the ones that will gather people around them, and people want to be near that person. But you got to ask, what is your heart? What do you really get excited about? What passion has God placed inside of you? What have you really been leaning into or thinking there's an inkling of? One of the things that you could have asked me early on in my ministry is, what's your heart, Brody? All right, what's your heart? And I would have said that kids would understand the Bible, because so many times we explain the Bible for adults and try to do that for kids, and it never works. And we wonder why we have a generation that's growing up going, I don't want to talk about the Bible. And I wanted to say, let's take the Bible and let's break it down so that kids can understand really complicated topics and they can get excited about that and the stories. If you were to ask me now, what gets me really excited? That still gets me excited. But what really gets me excited is that adults learn like kids. We start teaching at this level, and they're like, I have no idea what you're talking about. And so to break down really complicated topics into easy-to-understand things so that people get excited about God's big story and their place in it, that still gets me excited. It's just operating in a different environment. All right? And so their heart. Next, their abilities. Their abilities. Now, here's where I'll tell you. If you've been in a place for a long time and you have known parents, okay, and they have certain ability levels, all right, this is the parent's ability level, do not assume that that ability level is passed on to the next generation. All right, you got to get to know everyone on their individual level. My dad is a master carpenter. He is amazing. You can walk into, he built our house. The only thing he didn't do was pour the cement slab, because he didn't want to work that hard. All right, we did everything else on our own, and he knows how to do it. He can walk into a very expensive place, and he can do all the finished carpentry and the artwork with all of the different things. He makes furniture, shaker furniture. He does all sorts of things. Do you know what? I can't even hammer a nail in right. You know what my biggest home improvement win is this year? Last weekend, I went home and the hinge was coming off the door. And my wife had said, you know, when a guy in our small group who's actually good at carpentry stuff, when he comes over, we'll have him do it. And I was like, not in my house. I'm going to, you know, kind of that little competitive nature. I'm like, so I looked, and it was as easy as taking screws that stripped out that were this long and putting screws in that long. And I thought, man, I have arrived. That's how much ability I have. My dad could build his own building anytime or make all the furniture in it. I can put a screw into a wall. That's really all I can do. So don't assume that the gifts of the parent are passed on to the child. It means that we have, as we go over distance, we get to know people for their abilities. What are their abilities? What are the things that we want to assume and what actually are there? Next one, what's their personality? This is big because sometimes we would assume in a team setting or in a setting, the glory goes to those who can talk in front of people, right? Okay, so the people who get recognized are the ones who are up front. I would tell you that when I hired for a staff of 110 to 120 young people that were going to deal with 700 or 800 kids, what I would do is we would have a small number of what I call raging extroverts, all right? They extrovert all over everybody, all right? You can't help it. They could sit in a room and have, I met one last week, and I am convinced that he could have stood in front of a wall and preached a message and been happy with it because the wall might have actually talked back. But the thing is that I would get a very small section of that kind of person because they are going to be a big presence. Their personality is going to take up a lot of space. But what I will hire is I will hire 20 to 30 to maybe 40 really quiet guys and gals. Do you know why? Because I want that gut person who's going to be up front and create the excitement. But to surround that, I want a bunch of people who are going to sit with a small group of kids and carry on a conversation for longer than that extrovert has an attention span for. And that's when we work together. And so when we start talking about personalities, start looking at things like extroversion, outgoing, verbal acuity, things like that. But then don't build a whole team of that because you will never have deep relationships because they can't sit still long enough to do it. And I'm speaking from experience. This is me. All right? You need to have a balance, and so that personality piece is huge. And then experience. Experience is your last one. What have you experienced before that can add to this current thing? And no one is ever too young to use their experience. My 8-year-old, when she was 5, no, when she was 6 and a half. We're sitting at the table. My son is learning to use a spoon at that point in time, and I would put a spoon in his hand, and he would throw it down and dig with his fingers into the food. A man after my own heart. I really wish whoever invented silverware needs to be shot. But anyways, there's a long way to go on that one. But my son didn't want to use the spoon, and so he kept throwing it down, and we were ready to give up. And my daughter, at 6 and a half years old, looks over at my son, who's just a little bit over 1, maybe getting close to 1 and a half, and she takes the spoon, she puts it in his hand, and then she puts the spoon in her hand, and she goes, "It works like this." And he went exactly like she did. And you know what? My wife and I got up and walked in the other room. We're like, we're failures. But here's the thing. Here's the thing. She's 6 and a half, and she's already able to use experience, things she's learned to contribute to the current environment. When you're looking at somebody, think about their experience. Don't rely too much on it, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes, but think about their experience and then say, how can they contribute that piece of experience to this current environment to make us better as a team and so that they will feel like they are connected and they're a significant part of this. So, 3 things so far. Don't underestimate the power of asking, drawing people in. Don't underestimate the power of encouragement. Don't underestimate the power of relationship. I can tell already I have way too much information for this. So I'm going to move quickly. Power of example. Don't underestimate the power of example. Here's what 1 Timothy 4:12 says. Do not let anyone look down on you because you are young, but be an example for the believers in speech, in life, in love, in faith, and in purity. If you are going to empower people, part of the way that you empower people is that they watch you. And they figure out, because there's so many people right now that didn't have a great home situation, especially guys, other guys will watch you because there's so many places in a home where a guy that's in their teens and in their 20s didn't have a dad at home. And so they're looking at the guys ahead of them as kind of a father figure saying, what does it look like to be significant? What does it look like to be a player? What does it look like to be on the right track? And so when you start to look at this, be an example in your speech. in your speech. Now, I was part of Rotary International for a long time. Anybody a Rotarian in here? Anybody know what? Hey, there's my one. All right. Okay, so anyways, if you're a Rotarian, they talk about the importance of speech, and they give a four-way test, almost like a filter of what comes out of your mouth. And here's what it is. Before anything comes out of your mouth, you ask yourself these four questions. Is it the truth? Okay? Is it fair to all concerned? All right? Or am I telling my version of the story and making somebody else look bad? Okay? Is it fair to all concerned? Will it build goodwill and better friendships? All right? Not always is that the necessary question to answer yes to, but a lot of times you can tell truth and build goodwill and better friendships. We just don't. All right? And then the last one is it beneficial for all concerned? Or am I having a conversation about something that half the people in this group don't need to hear about? Okay? Is it the truth? Is it fair to all concerned? Will it build goodwill and better friendship? Is it beneficial for all concerned? And I'm going to add a fifth one. And my fellow Rotarian will say that's blasphemy. But here it is. Does it need to be said, or do I just need to say it? Okay? Now this, with our wives, gentlemen, this is a big deal. Does it need to be said, or do I just want to say it? I find that when I run my words through that filter, I swallow a lot of things. I will tell you that. Okay, but when we start saying, am I an example of my speech? Are the things that I'm saying, are they true? Or are they a version of the truth? Because people will figure that out really fast. Am I being fair to others? Because if I'm not being fair to others when you're with me, am I being fair to you when you're not with me? I don't know. It calls that into integrity. Is it going to build goodwill and better friendships? Is it beneficial? Am I just spewing and venting in front of everybody? Those things are really things that we need to ask, because our speech will give an example to those who are watching us. In speech and life, now this is where the two are connected, all right? Does your speech line up with your actions? Does your life live up to your mouth? And I will tell you, on a lot of things, this is a big deal. I have been caught almost messing this up. I've been caught messing it up too, but I'm not going to tell you those stories. I'll tell you the almost mess up, all right? So I had been here. I was preaching and talking about kindness and compassion and care for others in a sermon. I got on a plane with my family on Monday to go on vacation, and we were flying. We got to the place we were going to go. We were on our way back. We flew from Atlanta to Memphis. We got routed to Memphis, which Memphis is possibly the worst airport I've ever been in. And so we were there, and they kept delaying our plane and delaying our plane and delaying our plane and delaying our plane until I was really fed up. This was when my daughter was like 1 year old, and she was having a major meltdown. And you ever had, how many of you have kids? How many of you have kids? Okay, when they're really young and they have that major meltdown and the internal temperature starts to rise and you're like, okay, not only am I embarrassed, but now I'm furious at whoever didn't get us moving so that we had this meltdown. And so I was really ticked at the customer service people, and there was a line, and I got in line, and I was going to tell them where to go and how to get there and want answers, because nobody was getting answers. And so I started to work my way up through the line, and I'm just mulling over how very pointed I'm going to be, and that I'm going to get answers, and that I'm not going to get denied, because everybody in front of me was getting denied answers, because I don't actually think she had answers, but I wasn't convinced of that at that moment in time. And so I get close to the front. There's one person in front of me. I am ready to go after this, and somebody taps me on the shoulder in the Memphis airport, and I turn around. I don't know the person, but they look at me, and they go, "Don't you go to Elmbrook?" And I was like, it's like, crap. And this is not the moment for that. I had to take a moment and say, okay, I just preached this whole thing on compassion and care and treating others well. Now am I going to live it out even when I don't want to? And I'm sure you have a story like that. But here's the thing. Even if you don't have a story that's that built in, you have a moment where you have either by your knowledge or by lack of knowledge, somebody's been watching you, because people know you. You're a celebrity somewhere. Everybody's a celebrity somewhere. And your mouth has to match your life, and vice versa. Otherwise, the leaders behind you will not be empowered to move forward. They'll be empowered to move forward in not helpful ways instead of helpful ways. Speech, life, love. All right, I'm going to go through, and I'm just going to be really, really right down the line with 1 Corinthians 13. Guys, do our lives, are we patient? Are we kind? Do we love truthfulness? Do we protect the right things? Do we trust others to speak into us? Do we believe the best in others? Does our love last, or is it just fickle with whatever happens? Are we living out a love in our life that is actually reflective of what Jesus is all about? Because people are watching. I won't belabor that point because you probably hear it all the time. Our love makes a difference. Our love, our faith. For those of you in the marketplace, believe it or not, people will know your faith. And I know that some of you have been approached because people can see it in the way that you live. Your faith will speak volumes. Don't underestimate the power of your example in your faith. And then in your purity. Now, this is where we have done a disservice to this word, because whenever anybody talks about purity, particularly in the church, but almost anywhere, it's revolving around sexual purity. And sexual purity is a huge issue with guys. We've got to wrestle with that, and we've got to live in a way that's pure. But it's not only that kind of purity that this verse is talking about. What about our purity of character? What about our purity of intent? When we walk into a room, do people assume that we already have our agenda mapped out and we're going to try to move them towards that because it creates this type of thing? Or do they think that we come in with an open mind and an open heart and we're going to listen even though we're not going to be pushed one way or the other? Purity, our purity of sexual purity is important, but our purity of character, our purity of intent, our purity of agenda is very important, and people pick up on that stuff when you're tainted in those areas very quickly. So do not underestimate the power of your example. Here's what I would tell you, is that the quotes that will tell the most is, more is caught than taught. Is that the way you live your life will speak much more than the words that you say. And so don't underestimate the power of that. Next, power of celebration. Power of celebration. This is not balloons in a party and everybody wearing the same kind of t-shirts and celebrating something. This is, what are the things that are worth celebrating? If you're in a marketplace, what are the things that your business celebrates? What are the wins? If you're in a church setting, what are the wins? And how can you celebrate it in a way that encourages and empowers somebody to do more? See, we're always looking towards the next thing. We're never right where we are when we are there. We're always looking to the next thing. And so often we miss a chance to celebrate things that we've been really driving towards. I almost had this happen to me a few years ago. I was teaching in our children's ministry area, and we were teaching on restoration. Why you would teach children about restoration, I still don't know. But I did it that day. And we had this banner up in the back of the room. In the back of the room that said, I've been restored. And kids were supposed to go up there and write something on that. And I gave them verbal cues. And usually what happens when the person up front gives a verbal cue, that every kid in the room goes back and writes exactly what the person up front said on the board. And I was like, okay. So I always go back just in case somebody actually thought for themselves. And it's really a great practice, but often futile. And so that day I taught on restoration. I went back. I'm reading through these things, all the words that I had already said in kids' handwriting. And then I saw this orange thing down in the bottom right-hand corner. I'll never forget this. And this kid, I don't know if it was a little girl, a little boy, had written this: I've been restored this year because I was adopted. And I thought, huh, there's a kid that gets it. And that kid doesn't just get it because I spoke a brilliant message in the front. There's been a groundwork that's been laid in a small group. There's been a groundwork that's been laid in some junior leader sitting alongside. There's a whole slew of things that had to happen for that kid to get to that point. I should really tell him about that. And it went in one side of my head and out the other. I was like, I'll get to that. And then you know how that happens. You never get to it. Well, as I turned around, I looked down, and there was a woman who was sitting with one of my staff. And she was weeping. And we had invited parents in that day. And about halfway through, this woman had started crying. And I wasn't sure why. I figured I'm not that bad of a speaker. And so I don't think you're going to weep at that. And I made eye contact with one of the ladies that was on my staff. She went over and sat there. I thought they were long gone. I turned around. She was still sitting there. I went down and asked the question. She goes, the message that you gave today, that God had been restored, my husband left me yesterday. And I know that I'm not the one who can actually fix that, that God has to be part of that conversation. It was an aha moment for me. And so we had two moments in a room full of leaders that have been investing in this process for a long time. And what I did the next day is, we have a green room down here, and I went in there with a video camera and somebody, and I just took a headshot video for about 4 minutes and told those stories to the leaders. And I said, you know what? You had a big part of this, because the kids don't get this unless you're planting it. The kids don't get this unless you're nurturing it. The kids don't get this unless you give them opportunity to respond, and what you're doing makes a difference. Now, you can take that to the context that you're in. How do you see what you're aiming at? Because sometimes we keep aiming and aiming and aiming, and we never quite get there, it seems, but yet we've probably hit it 100 times and just never celebrated. And that's one of the things that we get to do, and that empowers people to do more. When they feel like, hey, we're building on something that's already moving forward, I'm going to go just that much harder because I sense that the mission is that important. And so don't underestimate the power of celebration. And the last one, don't underestimate the power of clarity and space. Now, this is where you're going to get stuck with a little bit of stuff that's just in my head that I will try to explain as best I can. Here's the thing. When you're going to empower leaders, I don't think I have a, if anybody has an eraser around here, I don't know. I'm just going to do this because I'm going to draw a lot more. But here's the deal. When we start to empower people, we're going to discover their shape. We're going to start to involve them in, I'll just say, the organization or the context that we're in. And then we've got to put them to work. But how do you put them to work? Because people don't operate well if they're guessing. They'll actually stay back because they don't want to offend or they don't want to overstep because then they're going to get slapped or they're going to get stepped on. And so how do we give people the ability to step forward with confidence and empower them to really live into and expand what we're already doing? I think we need to give them frameworks. And this is what I mean by frameworks, okay? And this is going to be a really rudimentary drawing. But let's say this is what we're trying to accomplish, all the pieces of what we're trying to accomplish. Thank you so much. Here's what you're going to do. You're going to take person X, and you got to give them some framework for their area. You need to give them boundaries that are clear and concise, but also empowering. Because here's the thing. If I were to take this job on, my expertise would probably get about that much done. All right, and that would get us by, but we're going to be so much better if we start to fill in all of this and explore. So what I need to do is give that person the boundaries, give them a couple of ideas that I have, and then set them loose to fill up that framework and do something more than I could ever do on my own. Here's what I'll tell you, and you got to be careful. This is a failure story, but and Grant, you will know this story. And here's what happened. First couple of years of our summer day camps, we wanted to do a water day. And I went to my leader, and I said, here's what I want you to do. I want it to be fun. I want those kids to go home, and I want them to talk about it for years, what they did. And they still do on this one. All right? Second thing, I want it to involve water. I do want it to involve water because it needs to be a water day. And the third thing is I want it to have a lot of energy. All right? Those are the three things I want for this. Go after it. Brainstorm with your team. And I let them loose. And I didn't think about it much more after that. And I went out the day that they were going to do this event on water day. And I walked out to the pond area. And there's this hill that goes down the pond. And there were tables stacked at different things all the way down the hill. And there were kids at the bottom, all lined up across the bottom, who were about to run up the hill, from what I remember. And there were leaders at the top and behind all those tables that had water balloons. And as the kids were running up, they were throwing water balloons down the hill at these little kids. And some of you are like, this is a recipe for disaster. Yes, because water balloons do not break most times. Now, he did exactly what I said. There was water. It was fun. They were going to talk about it for years, all right? And it was engaging. It was interactive. But what did I miss? Safe. Safe. It would have been fabulous to say safe because then it would have changed the whole dynamic of that. Now, what I'm saying, it's a funny story, and nobody got too seriously injured. But what I'm saying is that there are places where we give frameworks to people that allow them to know the ideas. And if I give good framework and a little bit of an idea, many times people will surprise us with how much more they'll bring to the table than we ever anticipated. And that is so empowering because you give them space and you give them clarity. And the beauty of this is that if you're doing all of these things, all right, this is you trying to take on the leadership of all these areas of a certain thing, and suddenly this person knocks it out of the park with this, and you're like, oh, maybe I could trust him with something else. I'm going to give him that. And then do the same thing, and they knock it out of the park, and pretty soon you have people, you have all sorts of people doing all sorts of things, and pretty soon they are filling this out, and we are much better as a group in an empowered setting than we ever were if it was all my ideas. But here's where we get dangerous, all right? Because as we start to fill in these other things and I stop doing all of these things, suddenly my space becomes much smaller. And as a leader, I start to go, well, am I necessary? And leaders get threatened and they start to get territorial and they start to pull away from that empowerment and they actually disempower and they move good teammates out of the picture. All right? And this is where you've got to figure out, okay, if you are a true believer in Jesus Christ and you understand that God is in control of these things and he calls you to things, there's a reason that these people are stepping in, and what might it be that God is calling you to? As your space shrinks here, he's giving you more capacity to step into something else. And you may see this as the big thing, but God may see it like this. Here's the overarching thing I have for your life. This is a small piece that's taken up a lot of your time, but as it takes up less because you're empowering, I can now move you to the other things that desperately need your attention. Don't underestimate the power of clarity and space because it will build something that is beyond what you ever imagined in that thing. Now, What time do I have to be done? Do I have 10 minutes? Eight. All right. So what if you're going to empower teams? What if you're going to empower teams? All right. If you're going to empower a team, there's a couple of things you need to recognize the importance of. First, you need to recognize the importance of mission. Mission. What's the point of your team? All right. What's the point of the Packers? To win the Super Bowl. All right. We don't always get there, but they're always aiming for that. What's the point of the Brewers? To win the... Well, to make... And we're done. All right. So, but you know, those teams have a really clear goal, and everything they do, whether it's popular or not popular, is built to move that direction. Here's the thing. Your teams are not going to be able to move forward if your mission is not crystal clear. And it has to be clear. It has to be articulated well. It has to be a little bit catchy so they can remember it. But the question is, how do you come to that mission? Now, I want to recommend to you a book called Church Unique, but the concept is broader than just church. Church Unique by Will Mancini is the guy. And what he talks about is that there is a collision where you find your mission. And it looks a little bit like this, and it's on your piece of paper, all right? In the church world, it's called the kingdom concept. And basically it says you look at the local predicament. If you are a church, you're looking at the needs in the community. If you're a business, you're looking for the gaps in service or product that you can say, man, we could really go for that. What is the local predicament? What's going on in here? And what are the needs that are there? You need to identify those. What are the resources? This is the collective potential. If I pull together all the people that I'm connected with or all the resources that I have available, what is that collective potential and how can I use it to meet the local predicament? And then there's this thing that nobody really understands, but he explains it in the book. It's called apostolic esprit. And it makes me feel not quite so manly when I say it. But anyways, all right. All right. Apostolic esprit. In the Bible, an apostle, Paul, was someone who went and started things and continued to push the message forward. Apostolic esprit is, what is God calling us to? What is God calling us to? And that happens in the church and in the marketplace. What is God calling us to? And we start to look at our local predicament and we look at our collective potential and we look at our apostolic esprit or what is God calling us to or what are we feeling called to? Then the collision of all those in here may be the clear mission that we should be aiming at. Because somewhere in the middle of that where they all overlap, that's going to be our sweet spot. And very few people look for that. They say, well, we're going to fill a need, but they never talk about all the resources that are there. They may say, hey, we've got this and we have those, and yet they never talk about what is that call? What might God be charging us to do even in a marketplace environment? And so you got to look at all three of those. And once you look at all three of those, then you start to articulate a clear mission so the team knows what it's going to aim about. And this doesn't have to be a business team. This might be a smaller team. And what you do is then you look at that and you say, okay, once we've articulated our vision and our mission, then we got to go back to what I told you in the first place. The wow, the oh yeah, the I'm bored and I know it without you. And you need to say it so many times that you get through the wow and you get through the oh yeah and you get through the I'm bored till they look at you like a teenager would and they roll their eyes and they go, I know it without you. And then you know you've been successful even if they just think they've insulted you. It's a great victory. It's really fun to sit in your chair and hear it. So first thing, know your mission. Second, you need to be aware of the importance of your own. I used poor wording here, so I'm just going to clean it up. The importance of your own awareness of yourself. If you're going to empower teams, you need to know how you lead. You need to know what it's like to work for you. You need to have an outside view of yourself. It's called emotional intelligence in the workplace today. Emotional IQ. But if you don't know what it's like to be you, if you can't verbally articulate what you're like, you're going to lead blindly. And leading by the gut for a while is really helpful. Leading by the gut for a long period of time doesn't set you up well. And so you need to know about yourself. If you're looking for tools to know about yourself, the MBTI, the Myers-Briggs personality type, I'd encourage you to take it. There's free versions online. There's other things, though. The Thomas Kilman conflict mode. If you want to know how you deal with conflict, do you run away from it? Do you, like a rhinoceros, charge in and spear everybody with your horns in the middle of it? That's a good thing to know. Or do you compromise so it's a win-win? Or do you collaborate so that everybody comes along together? Or do you accommodate so that you don't really want to mess with it, but you don't really want to run away from it? This will help you articulate who you are. There's another thing that I would... the Thomas Kilman conflict mode. There you go. But there's also something else I would recommend, and this is to know yourself. And then I'm probably going to have to cut, and I hate to say it, but this will be the last one I do. But I'll recommend some other resources. The other thing is Bill Hybels talks about your leadership number. And this has been really influential for me when looking at my organization, all right? And this is, if you take yourself or others and you put them on a scale 1 to 10 as a leader, okay? Now, this is not demeaning their personality. This isn't something you're going to share in a review, all right? You're a 4 or anything like that. But you're going to get it as a leader. You're going to say somewhere on this scale, right here, if you're in this room, you're already a 2 because you care about empowering people enough to come and sit in a room. But if you're nobody's there because that's Jesus himself, all right? And so somewhere in between a 2 and a 9 is what you're going to be. Somewhere about a 7, you stop being scared of other people being good leaders around you. Okay, so let me give you that context. But here's the thing. If you start looking at teams that you're leading or teams that you're watching being led, if a team is full of 4s and under, it's not an HR problem. It's a leader problem. Because here's the thing, is that most leaders, whatever your number is, you will hire people that are less capable than you because they're not a threat. All right? But if for some great chance you hire somebody that's so much more capable than you, if you're a 4 and you hire an 8, they won't stay long because you won't lead them in a direction. They'll be waiting on you for so long that they'll go find greener pastures. And so when you're talking about leadership awareness, understand your style, understand your conflict style, understand the way that you process, understand the way that you lead, and also understand your leadership number. And if you can change your leadership number, you can keep improving that. And the more you improve it, the better leaders you're going to attract to your team, and the better your team is going to be able to accomplish the mission. All right? Leadership awareness is huge. I'm going to tell you the other two just so you have it. It's important that you gather the right people. And there's a top right-hand corner on the front of your thing is musings from my brain on what we look for. Chemistry over talent, culture over creativity, humility over preference, and character over personality. Here's what I would tell you. The right-hand side of that, if you circle that, that is many times what you will find in a resume and in an interview. If you look on the left-hand side, those are the ways that we have to be looking in order for our teams to be most effective. So make sure you're gathering the right team members. And last, don't underestimate the power of trust. I would recommend to you Patrick Lencioni's book, The 5 Dysfunctions of Team. And he talks about this trust pyramid, and he talks about the really difficult things that happen when we don't value trust and when we don't work to build trust. So I have 1 minute left. So here's the question. Where do you start? Where do you start empowering? Where do you start getting practice to empower? Start at home. Start at home. If you're beyond having kids, empower your spouse, encourage her. All right? Because that's where that you're going to see quick results there. If you have kids in your house or grandkids in your house, start there. They are the primary. If you are going to leave a legacy, it's not going to be in your business nearly as much as it's going to be in your family. All right? And so start at home. And then everywhere else, start small and be consistent. Many people will try to start the whole thing, and then they get themselves in trouble because they can't hold it together. Start small, incrementally, be consistent. And I've got to be done or they're going to yank me off here. Thanks, guys. I hope you have a great day. And I'll be up here to talk.